Okay. Okay, well, our program, and I see that a large part of the audience is our program, but I know there are people here from the other programs and from UCSB as well. But our program has the short title, Accretion and Explosion. And the explosions that we're most interested in are type 1A supernovae. For our purposes, the most important thing about these explosions is that, first of all, they're very bright. We can see them from far away. Typical energies are in the range of 10 to the 51 ergs, 10 to the 44 joules. The other very important thing about them is that although they're not all identical to each other, they're similar enough that they're often referred to as standardizable candles. So in other words, if you see the light curve of such an explosion, and by this I simply mean the amount of light that we get as a function of time, you can figure out how bright this was at peak. So these two things together, the fact that they're very bright, the fact that they're standardizable, means that we can use them to probe the distant universe. And in fact, that's what has been done. And in the first talk that was given as part of our program, the first of the Blackboard seminars, Bob Kirshner did a great job of giving us an overview of what these explosions are, what their properties are, and how they've been used so far in cosmology. And it's been incredible. I'm sure many of you, perhaps most of you, have heard about these results, the establishment that not only is the universe expanding, but we have also measured both deceleration in the earlier universe and acceleration in the present-day universe, and the implications that this has for dark energy. So this is the larger significance of the questions that we've been asking in our program. Okay, now given the immense importance of these explosions for cosmology, it's interesting and perhaps both disappointing and challenging to note that we really do not understand exactly what these systems are. If I were to show you a binary system, well, for some of them, we'd be able to say, no, that definitely will never become a type 1A supernova. But for some of them, we just really don't know, because we don't know exactly which binary systems are the progenitors. And then once you've identified a progenitor and you get it to the right state, the question is, will it explode? Well, the third of our four coordinators, Lars, is going to tell us about that when he gives his Blackboard seminar. So I'm going to talk about the progenitors, the binary systems that might become type 1A supernovae, and I hope in the talk to give you some idea of what we do know, and also of the interesting areas that we're still exploring, the things that we do not yet know about the progenitor systems. Now, when people think about supernovae, probably the first thing that comes to mind in most cases is the end state of massive stars. When a star that's more than something around 8 solar masses ends its lifetime as a nuclear burning entity, it undergoes an implosion and explosion, which we refer to as a core collapse supernova or a type 2 supernova. The end result is a neutron star or a black hole. Those types of explosions are characterized by having a lot of hydrogen and helium that we can see in the spectrum after the explosion, because you had the envelope of the star, which was very rich in hydrogen and helium. And even if that envelope somehow was expelled before the explosion itself, some of this hydrogen-rich and helium-rich material will be in the vicinity of the exploding system. But Type 1A supernovae are different. First of all, we don't see any hydrogen or helium in the spectrum. And secondly, we see that these go off not only in galaxies that have ongoing star formation, galaxies similar to our own, but they also go off in very old galaxies, elliptical galaxies, where there seems to be no ongoing star formation. So we know that these are not the end states of massive young stars. But instead, the conjecture is that these are exploding white dwarfs. You ask yourself, why would a white dwarf explode? Well, the model that we currently have is that you have a white dwarf where the gravitational pull, the the force that would want to make it collapse is balanced by electron degeneracy pressure. And this Chandrasekhar discovered above a certain mass, the so-called Chandrasekhar mass of around 1.4 solar masses, that degeneracy pressure can no longer support the star against gravity, and something dramatic has to happen. And for stars, for white dwarfs that started out at about 1.2 solar masses or more than that, that something that happens may very well be a collapse to a neutron star, so-called accretion-induced collapse. And for white dwarfs that started out with lower mass, so-called carbon-oxygen white dwarfs, that end state, we think, is a type 1A supernova. So this is the basic model that we have. The white dwarf somehow gains mass. Now, most of the interstellar medium is not dense enough to support the conjecture that the white dwarf is just traveling around as a single system after it becomes a white dwarf and gets enough mass from the interstellar medium. In general, you need a companion star from which the white dwarf can somehow steal some matter. And so the two models that we have, it's one model, this white dwarf exploding, but the two binary models we have are the so-called single degenerate model and the double degenerate model. In the single degenerate model, the white dwarf has a companion that is an extended star. It's not a compact object like a white dwarf neutron star or black hole. That star is filling what we call its Roche lobe, and all that means, as I'll explain in a few moments, is that matter that comes here is likely to actually come under the gravitational influence of the white dwarf and accrete onto it. And so the white dwarf accretes matter from this extended companion, and at some point it gets enough matter that it reaches the Chandrasekhar mass and it explodes. So that's the single degenerate model. In the double degenerate model, the companion is another white dwarf, and these two come closer and closer under the agency of gravitational radiation, and eventually they merge. And again, we have the possibility of a type 1A explosion. Now, you may think that I'll be able to tell you at the end of this talk which of these models is correct. And I'm going to tell you now that I will not be able to do that because we simply don't know. We're not even sure that one of them is the dominant model. It could be that both of them contribute in some way. It could be that one of them, and in particular this one I think is at risk, one of them doesn't contribute at all. We just simply don't know. And so all I'd like to do today is to give you the insider's view, and I'm sure I'll have some help from some of my other conference participants here, insider's view of what are the uncertainties, what are the things that we need to work a little bit harder on, and what are the implications of this. So I'm going to start because, you know, we have this binary model, both of them are binary models. We need to know a little bit about stars and stars and binaries to say anything about this, say anything concrete. Stellar evolution, this is the quickest course you'll ever have. It's stellar evolution. Okay. You need to know very little. It's useful to know that when a star is on the main sequence, it is burning hydrogen to helium. And that's most of the star's lifetime. When it's on the main sequence, its radius is more or less proportional to the mass. Okay. So a star that's five times as massive as the sun will have a radius that is approximately five times as large. Ah, the astronomers let me get away with that. Okay. Lifetime. Okay, stellar lifetime is much shorter for more massive stars. Okay, this again is an approximation. I think I used the same one you used, Bob, in your talk. Okay, if you have a star that is much more massive than the sun, in particular one of the ones that's going to become a core collapse supernova, its lifetime is only on the order of tens of millions of years, whereas our sun is presently, we think, about 5 billion years old and will stay on the main sequence for another 5 billion years. Now, this is the crucial element for binary evolution. Once the star leaves the main sequence, then it begins to expand. And this obviously affects the way it interacts with its companion. It expands to become larger than the distance between it and its companion. Clearly something interesting is going to happen. And what is our final element of stellar evolution? Well, the end state, as we've already mentioned, is either a white dwarf, neutron star, or black hole. We're interested in this case. Okay, now on to binaries. And this is really where the fun begins. Because binaries are just the most incredibly wonderful things. But the world... Okay, first of all, why are they interesting? Well, first reason is that they are ubiquitous. And probably everybody here has heard the statistic that more than half of all stellar systems are in binaries. So you point your finger at some star tonight that's up in the sky, better than 50% chance that star is not a star, but it's a binary system. Now, it's also interesting to note, it doesn't come directly into our discussion here, but I have to mention it, that there's a chance somewhere between 15 and 25% that when you point your finger, you're pointing at something that's a triple or higher. The pole star is a triple star. One of the stars in the handle of the Big Dipper is a quadruple star. Last night I read about a stellar system where we have, looks like two stars orbiting each other in an orbit that lasts tens of thousands of years, roughly 20,000 years. Each one is a binary, and one of each of these is also a binary. So we have a sextuple, and there are reports of even seven tuples. I'm not sure that they've been verified. Okay, so this is just remarkable. Now, this is just a fact you can quote to people. But what really makes binaries interesting is that the stars in a binary interact with each other. In fact, one of our participants said this a little bit less delicately. I will say that the study of binary stars is like the study of love relationships among stars. They interact with each other. And just like in a marriage, they can live longer because they're in a binary. They can live shorter because they're in a binary. And they can do all sorts of interesting things that make them brighter for periods of time. Stellar binarity is just amazing. I'm going to give you two short examples, or maybe three short examples over here, just to show you how that works. Now, sometimes we look at clusters, old clusters, globular clusters, and these stars were all formed at one time. So we know that the stellar age should be more than a certain amount, and all the stars should be older than that. And that means that none of them should be more massive than a certain amount. The star that would have evolved in time shorter than the lifetime of the cluster shouldn't be there. Yet we do see in clusters objects, stars called blue stragglers, that are brighter than they should be. And they also appear to be more massive than they should be. They're bluer than they should be. That's why they're called blue stragglers. They're not really straggling in space. They're straggling on what we call the HR diagram. Now, how could that possibly come to be? Well, suppose we have one star which is more massive, and suppose that it somehow comes to fill its Roche lobe and to transfer mass onto the companion. It becomes less massive. In principle, it could live for a longer time, although the state of evolution of this star, when it does, it will help to determine its age. This guy becomes more massive. It starts burning nuclear fuel faster, and it's now going to die sooner than it otherwise would have. And this becomes the blue straggler. So that's one example. Another is when you have something, it could be an extended star, but it's especially interesting if it's a compact object, a white dwarf, neutron star, or black hole, and there's an extended star near it filling its Roche lobe, donating matter. In this case, accretion energy, just the gravitational potential energy of the matter that is falling down onto the compact object, can cause the system to become very bright, much brighter than it would otherwise be. So luminosities of 10 to the 36 to 10 to the 39 ergs per second are achieved, often at X-ray wavelengths. And so these are remarkable in another way now. You take a look at a galaxy. Let's think of a galaxy that's roughly 8 megaparsecs away, like M104, the Sombrero Galaxy. Mostly when you look at that, what you're seeing is the combined light of hundreds of billions of stars. But if you take an X-ray image of this galaxy, you will see hundreds of point sources. Those point sources are the X-ray binaries that are lit up. They're as bright as they are at X-ray wavelengths because of accretion. And so they are the individual stellar systems in that distant galaxy that we can study in detail. And we'll come back to study an example of them a little bit later on. Finally, in this process of accretion, it could be that some of the accreted matter burns. And for us, that's relevant because in the case of trying to grow a white dwarf, you would like accreted matter to burn and actually be retained by that white dwarf. That's an important piece of growing a white dwarf to the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay? So that's the background. Now, I see we're not doing as well for time as I would like, so I'm just simply going to mention a few things here. In particular, that when stars interact, they can interact through what we call dissipative processes, like gravitational radiation and magnetic braking. And what that means, these are forces that lead to loss of angular momentum from the system, and therefore the components can move closer to each other. We're very proud of this one, gravitational radiation. We're proud of it because we understand it from first principles. So this comes directly from Einstein's theory. We know that we're still attempting to detect gravity waves. That hasn't yet been achieved, although we hope it will be over the next decade or so. But I remember attending a talk by Ray Weiss, who spent a lot of time building systems that could detect gravity waves. And he said, you know, if there's ever a Nobel Prize in this area, it should go to Joe Taylor, because he and his student Hulse have essentially verified that gravitational radiation exists by studying the changes that we can detect in a double neutron star system, where one of the neutron stars is a pulsar. And right immediately after that, I'm sure he was on the nominating committee, because within a few months, Joe Taylor had won the Nobel Prize for exactly that work. But the point is, we understand this, and we use this in binary evolution. The problem is that until we get to a case like this, where we have two compact objects, the timescales involved here are a little bit too long. And therefore, in many of the binaries that we study, we always include it because we understand it. But it often is not playing the major role in forcing evolution, except in certain special cases. There's another very interesting dissipative force, magnetic braking, which if we have some time later on, I'd be happy to talk a little more about it. But this is a remarkable situation where winds from one of the stars are magnetically constrained, and so they carry angular momentum away from that star, thereby spinning it down. And real stars do spin down. As they get older, they spin less and less fast. But if this star happens to be in a close binary and it's tidally locked to its companion, as it loses spin angular momentum, the companion is trying to spin it up again. There's a torque. That angular momentum that's extracted eventually is extracted at the expense of orbital angular momentum, and the two stars can come closer together. And therefore, the star that lost the angular momentum actually ends up spinning more quickly. So it's kind of an interesting situation. Do we understand it? Well, I just said the word magnetic field, and I've also said the word winds. These are two things we do not understand very well from first principles. We can't predict them as well as we can something like gravitational radiation. And in fact, we parameterize our ignorance by this parameter gamma, and there's a very nice discussion of this in Ed Vandenhoevel's talk. which he gave as part of the workshop. Okay, now the other thing that can happen, of course, is that, as I mentioned earlier, the giant can grow, and therefore the giant can fill its Roche lobe, or if the separation between the stars becomes smaller, one of the stars can fill its Roche lobe in that way. And all that means, for the purposes of this talk, is that mass from the star that fills its Roche lobe will now come under the gravitational influence of the other star. Generally, conservation of angular momentum means that there will be a disk, and this star can now potentially accrete some of the matter that came from the companion. So that's what we're talking about. But when a star fills its Roche lobe, is that what will happen? Will you have a nice epoch of mass transfer in which this star could potentially gain mass? Remember, that's what we're trying to do to our white dwarf, to turn it into a type 1a supernova. Or do you find a situation where the very process of mass transfer becomes unstable and you end up with what we call a common envelope, where this star loses its envelope on a dynamical time scale? The envelope engulfs the core of the mass-losing star as well as the other star, and eventually the two stars spinning, revolving around each other in this envelope succeed in kicking out the mass. And in doing that, they're going to lose angular momentum, come closer together. And you'll now have a new binary. The envelope is gone. You'll have a new binary with this star in orbit with the core of that star. You can see already what's happening here. It's those types of systems that give rise to double degenerates, right? And it's this type of system that could be the single degenerate, which leads to a type 1a supernova during the process of mass transfer, stable mass transfer. Okay. So I think now you have all the background you need to grow a white dwarf. You may ask, do we know that there are binaries in which a white dwarf is accreting matter from a companion? And the answer is yes. We know of many binaries where a white dwarf is accreting mass. The most common type of binary where this type of process, well, let me just say this type of process is happening. We don't know if it'll go all the way to the Chandrasekhar mass. It's called a cataclysmic variable. And Lars and his collaborators have shown that the rate at which these CVs form is comparable to the rate of type 1a supernovae. So that would be a good thing. But the downside of that is that they probably have almost no chance of ever becoming type 1a supernovae. The reason is simple. As I mentioned earlier, the Chandrasekhar mass is around 1.4 solar masses. In CVs, the typical mass of the white dwarf is 0.6, 0.7, 0.8 solar masses. The typical mass of the donor star is significantly smaller, typically on the order of a tenth or a few tenths of a solar mass. The two masses don't add up to enough mass. And not only that, but the white dwarf probably doesn't even get to keep much of the mass that comes under its influence through the force of gravity. And to show you that, I have drawn this graph, which comes from computations of many groups starting in late 70s, early 80s, and continuing up to today. General agreement is that if you have a white dwarf of mass ranging from 0.6 to 1.3 solar masses, and if it is accreting mass at a rate m dot, we can say roughly, if the white dwarf is right here, let's say a 0.7 solar mass white dwarf accreting at 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year, we can say roughly what happens to the matter that is accreted by the white dwarf. This area down here corresponds to the many CVs that we know of. And in this area below the steady burning region, matter accretes for a while, And I'm talking about hydrogen-rich matter, accretes for a while, forms a layer on the surface of the white dwarf, and after some time it ignites and we have a nova explosion. Galaxy like M31, we see something like 30 or 40 novae per year. A little bit debate on the exact number, but around 30 or so novae per year that we see in that galaxy. And in a nova explosion, we know that some mass is likely ejected, some fraction of the mass that was accreted since the last nova, and possibly even more. So when a white dwarf is accreting down here someplace, it's very unlikely that it's going to be a type 1a supernova. As you go, for a given white dwarf mass, as you go closer and closer to this pink line, as you increase M dot, the nova explosions become more frequent and less violent, and there is a possibility of retaining some of that mass. And finally, you reach a limit where the nuclear burning becomes quasi-steady, almost steady, and in this case, the white dwarf is burning the matter as it accretes, and it can retain the matter. So if all you knew was this diagram, you would probably immediately say, if we're looking for accreting white dwarfs that could potentially be type 1a progenitors, let's look for those that are in this steady burning regime. And if you were to predict what these would look like, how do you look for them? You would say, well, KT should range from something like 10 to 100 electron volts, and the luminosity would be something like 10 to the 37 or 10 to the 38 ergs per second, so 10,000, 100,000 times as luminous as our sun, and that's what you would be looking for. Now, this story now becomes a KITP story, because in the early 1990s, Joachim Trumper visited here during a workshop on neutron stars. And he presented some of the early results from the ROSAT X-ray satellite. And among the early results, and I think it's probably among the most significant results that ROSAT discovered, was that there was a class of very soft X-ray sources. We've known some of the individuals before, but now they had discovered something like a dozen locally, that is in our galaxy and in the Magellanic Cloud, something like 15 in M31, the nearest big galaxy. And these sources had this range of temperatures and this range of luminosities. Of course, people thought most X-ray sources, most X-ray binaries are neutron stars or black holes. So when they came here, that was the working hypothesis. Fortunately, Ed Vandenheuvel and his collaborators were here. They looked at this and said, this looks like a white dwarf. And you can do that calculation very simply if you just take a look at the effective temperature and the luminosity and compute the effective radius. You come up with something like a white dwarf effective radius. And it became clear that we might be looking at steady burning on the surface of a white dwarf. These white dwarfs could be genuinely accreting matter and keeping it, burning that matter so that they can retain it. And most importantly, Ed and his collaborators constructed a binary model for these systems. And in their binary model, you have a donor and you have a white dwarf. The mass of the donor is typically somewhat greater than the mass of the white dwarf. And it may not be exactly on the main sequence, but maybe slightly evolved. So if it's a true solar mass star, maybe its radius is something like 3 or 4 solar radii. And in this case, when you compute the value of M dot, the rate at which the donor loses mass, you find that this denominator becomes small enough and M dot therefore becomes large enough to place you in this steady burning region and to give the white dwarf a chance to genuinely accrete matter. So this was a very exciting discovery. Now, after that, what we did is we did some what we call population synthesis studies, starting with a population of binaries, to try to see how many of them would actually become supersoft sources. And what we discovered is that, in fact, a galaxy like ours could have on the order of 1,000 of these sources. And take a look at this range of temperatures. In this range, radiation is highly ionizing. And so radiation from these sources can be absorbed by gas. So if one of them happens to be located in our galactic disk and it's several kiloparsecs from us, we won't see this. And just to give you a scale, 8 kiloparsecs is the distance between us and the center of the galaxy. Yes.
So what happens if the accretion rate is above that narrow band?
Interesting question. That actually, on the answer to that question, may hinge the answer, you know, whether or not these single degenerates become type 1a supernovae or not. Because if when you use your binary evolution calculations, you compute M dot, you find out that the system is up here. If the system is able to eject that mass in the form of winds, then the binary evolution can proceed steadily and the white dwarf can continue to accrete mass. In many cases, if you cannot get rid of that mass, you enter the common envelope. And the core of the donor will then simply spiral in to the white dwarf. The envelope will be expelled. They might not come exactly together. They'll be separated by some distance, and later on, gravitational radiation will do the job. So that is the crucial thing. And if you take a look at some of the early papers, and here you see Red Giant. And later on, after we found that you really needed to eject winds in order to have a significant type 1a rate from this channel, we discovered that actually wind solutions were consistent. So, but do we know for sure whether the winds are generated in real physical systems? No, not yet. So this is the key issue. Okay. So these supersoft sources then became very important to our understanding of the type 1a progenitor problem. Now, just to elaborate on this point, I just want to consider, for example, one binary where this mass is greater than that. And suppose this is something like 0.8 solar masses, and this is something like 1.8 solar masses. Turns out that this very high rate of mass transfer generally will slow down once the masses of these two equalize. So you can see over here the total mass of the system is 2.6. If the white dwarf, let this one be the white dwarf, if the white dwarf could gain all of the matter during that heavy M dot range, it would come up to 1.3 solar masses. Not quite right. And it probably won't gain all of the matter. So the systems that you really want, that are very likely to be the progenitors, may have a more massive donor or perhaps a somewhat more evolved donor. For those cases, although I won't show you the calculations, this denominator can go through zero, indicating that the mass transfer process is not stable, and therefore you will have a common envelope. The only thing that can control this denominator is that it does have a dependence on parameters, in particular beta, the fraction of mass that's retained by the white dwarf. If there are winds, beta can be close to zero for some time. And also the amount of angular momentum that's carried away by any mass that is ejected. So understanding these two things from first principles is very important if we're going to predict the rate of type 1a supernovae that come from the single degenerate model. Okay, now what I would like to do is to show you the elements of population synthesis. So what does nature do? Well, nature starts out with a population of hundreds of millions of binaries, and those binaries evolve. The stars in them evolve, the binaries themselves evolve, Some of them become mass transfer binaries in which eventually a white dwarf is gaining mass from a companion. And if we can consider each of those, if we can figure out how much mass is accreted by the white dwarf, we can then compute the rate at which we expect type 1a supernovae to occur in galaxies. And if we do a really good job, we can also compute what these systems look like, what each of them looks like, so that we can perhaps even predict which of the stars around us, which of the binaries around us may correspond to progenitors. So how do we do this? Well, this is a kind of what we call in astronomy a cartoon. And I'm showing you an initial state, which is determined by the values of two masses. Let's assume M1 is more massive than M2. And a separation between the two. Of course, we also have some orbital eccentricity, but I'll leave that out of this simple picture. And now we can ask ourselves, well, what happens? Well, in one case, if these two are far enough apart, then the two stars may never fill their Roche lobe, and what you end up with is simply two white dwarfs, in this case in a very wide orbit. And I'll just mention that the time for gravitational radiation to bring them together scales as the fourth power of the separation. If these are an AU apart, the time, if I remember correctly, becomes something like 10 to the 17 years. And put them farther apart, it becomes even longer. So this means that in the far distant universe, way beyond today's age of the universe, way beyond the so-called Hubble time, interesting things are going to be happening. But they're not going to be the type 1a supernovae we see today. Okay, so what about if M1 does fill its Roche lobe? Well, depending on its mass and the separation when that happens, you will either have a common envelope or you will have an epoch of stable mass transfer. In this case, there's a possibility that the companion will become even more massive, and if we could measure its age, we would find out after mass transfer that it is a blue straggler. Whichever thing happens, in the end, you have a star in orbit with a white dwarf, which is the remnant of this M1. Okay, so you've gotten through the first stage. Now, when M2 evolves, or perhaps through the agency of dissipative processes, M2 may fill its Roche lobe, but it may not. Now, if it never does, then either the end state is again going to be these two white dwarfs in a relatively wide orbit, or it could be that just because you have a giant in orbit with a white dwarf for a while, the giant, I didn't mention there, can have very, very strong winds, and a portion of those winds could be accreted by the companion star. And when that happens, there is what we call a symbiotic system, and it is possible, although as Lev and others have shown, probably unlikely, for this to gain enough mass that the white dwarf achieves the Chandrasekhar mass and either becomes a neutron star or a type 1a supernovae. In most cases, we don't expect that to happen, and so we go again up to this end state of two white dwarfs in orbit with each other. Now, if M2 does fill its Roche lobe, it could have a common envelope, leading again to this same kind of end state, different range of separation. If there is mass transfer, we will either have a CV, or a supersoft source, a binary supersoft source in a close orbit, a few hours to possibly a few days of orbital period, or in a wider system if M2 becomes a giant before mass transfer starts. And in these two cases, you could either have an accretion-induced collapse, a type 1a supernovae, or an end state that is, again, the double white dwarf end state. For CVs, the end state is almost certainly something like the double white dwarf end state. So if you've taken this all in, you'll see that it's actually very simple. you start out, really it is. If I really wanted to make it look more confusing than it is, Lev has wonderful pictures of this. I would have shown some of his trees of evolution. It's really very simple. You start out with the binary where the two components each have a mass of less than about 8 solar masses. In the end, you either get two white dwarfs in a binary that will eventually spiral in, or you get a type 1a supernova, or you get an accretion-induced collapse. And what we are trying to do from the theoretical perspective is to compute what the fraction of each of these end states is. And we have lots of preliminary calculations. Some of them say we can do it. And those that say we can do it make very optimistic assumptions about the winds in these states or exactly what it is that's happening up over here. Some of them say the rate for the single degenerate channel is very close to zero. But honestly, I think we have a lot more theoretical work to do to understand the single degenerate channel. And it's very clear the physics that needs to be explored in more detail. It really has to do with the possibility of mass ejection from these systems and what happens to mass that is ejected. So I think there's been a lot of progress in the years since supersoft sources were discovered. But a lot of that progress also comes from observations. So I want to mention something. And I still have about, 15 minutes or so, is that right? Okay. I said how important supersoft sources are. And you saw these luminosities, right? Potentially these are observable in other galaxies. And we have observed them in other galaxies. We've had a big program over the past several years to attempt to find them there because they're so hard to find in our own galaxy. Now, let's suppose the single degenerate model is correct. We know it takes about 10 to the 6 years for a white dwarf to go from typical initial masses to the Chandrasekhar mass. We know how bright they are and their high temperature. So we know that we can see almost the entire population of these bright supersoft sources in external galaxies. Using the lifetime and using the type 1a supernova rate of something like 0.3 per century, we can compute how many there should be active today. So we look up at a galaxy like the Sombrero Galaxy or like the Pinwheel Galaxy, which we see face on, beautiful image. And what we predict is that in order for the type 1a supernovae, where the white dwarf achieves the Chandrasekhar mass, to be creating all of the type 1a supernovae we expect in these galaxies, there must be on the order of 1,000 active accretors which are undergoing nuclear burning today. So we can take the Chandra X-ray Observatory, XMM X-ray Observatory, look at these galaxies and see what we see. And we see about 20. 30, sometimes 50. In no way do we come close enough to the predicted numbers. So we now have to ask ourselves, is this a failure of the single degenerate model? It could be. But it could also be that these winds that we need are actually being generated, and because this radiation is so soft, it's absorbed by the winds that are generated by the system itself, and it's all fully self-consistent. We need winds. The winds are there. They obscure the systems, and we can't see them. Okay? So, now, is that a theory? Okay. So what is it? We actually know there are winds in some supersoft sources, right? If there really are on the order of 1,000 white dwarfs that are approaching the Chandrasekhar mass in our galaxy, a few dozen of them are within a kiloparsec. We should be able to find them. They're highly luminous. They're very bright. And if the radiation isn't getting out at these wavelengths, it's getting out at some set of wavelengths. So one thing we can do is we can look for these. And this is a program I strongly advocate. And we're trying to make a little bit of progress along this direction. What else? Well, the strongest constraints on the single degenerate model do come from observations. I just gave you one example. But there's another very strong example. And that is this. In these single degenerate models, you have a donor, which is either very rich in hydrogen or helium or some combination thereof. Matter accretes from that donor to the white dwarf. In the explosion, some of that material must be blown out. There should be some evidence of hydrogen and helium in the spectra. At the moment, there's no evidence for this, but the observationalists are zeroing in on this, and they're, you know, coming to a point where we may be able to place strict limits on how much hydrogen or helium-rich material there was in the initial state. They can do this at a level that's probably a few orders of magnitude better than we're doing now. And that may sound a lot, but they've made huge progress over the past decade or so. Then this class of model could potentially also be ruled out. There's another important thing in the end state. If you have a single degenerate system that becomes a type 1A supernova, what happens to the donor star? Right? Well, part of it may be, should be hydrogen and helium that you can see, but in the couple of local supernova remnants that we think were due to type 1A supernovae, we can also look for the progenitor star. We can look for the donor star. And so far, I would say results on that are divided, whether or not donor stars have been found. Other people may characterize that a little bit differently. So what are some of the other things we can do to check? Well, I happen to think we're at a great time for this type of research. Okay, and the reason is, hi David, that's okay. It's all on tape. So the reason I think it's a great time for this is that we are making a lot of progress in terms of doing these X-ray studies. We now have X-ray data for 134 galaxies. But in addition to that, we are at the beginning of a new era in astronomy where wide field monitoring programs are about to begin. Over the next decade, there are two in particular, PanSTARRS and LSST, that will each be monitoring the sky. Together, they'll get the whole sky, monitoring each region several times a month, perhaps as often as every few days. Now, what was the most common end state? Well, most common end state are these two white dwarfs in orbit with each other. Most of these do not have the Chandrasekhar mass, if you take the mass in total. But many of them will merge over a time period far less than the Hubble time. And those mergers will be associated with the release of significant amounts of energy. So we can look for unusual events, and this is something that Lars is also advocating for reasons very much related to this. We can look for these events, and we can see if they're there. So we will have predictions of the numbers of CVs, the numbers of supersoft sources, the numbers of symbiotics, and the numbers of mergers. Observations that are either ongoing or that will be greatly enhanced over the next 10, 15 years can actually therefore pin us down at crucial points of this evolution and can tell us which of these channels is taken by nature and how frequently. So we have the opportunity to actually get very important feedback from observations that can then be used to refine these calculations. And if we haven't been able to do it from first principles, these observations will tell us what role mass loss plays in the single degenerate models. So I think that's a very exciting prospect. Also, it's possible that LISA will be launched, and LISA will be very sensitive to white dwarf binaries, one of our common end states. That's another crucial piece of evidence in this picture. So although I cannot give you a concrete answer today, what I can say is that I'm reasonably confident that we will know at least which of these models, the single degenerate or double degenerate, plays an important role, or possibly if they both do, sometime over the next 10 to 20 years. So that's not a long time scale given how long this problem has been outstanding. And so finally I come to a quick question, which I think is kind of the beauty of these Blackboard seminars, right? That we're talking not just to our own group, but to groups who may never have really thought about type 1A supernovae or thought that they were particularly interesting or important. So the question that falls on us as speakers to address is, why should you care about this? Well, I don't know that you need to care about it, but cosmology is something that it's kind of interesting to know. What is the future of the universe? And without really understanding the nature of type 1A supernovae, we will ultimately reach a point where we need to know more in order to be able to use these, to continue to use them as tools. As scientists, it's certainly unsatisfying not to understand the fundamental nature of one of our most important tools. So we have to proceed with this line of research. Now, as I was preparing the talk, I also thought of something else, because I know we have a lot of biologists here. And so I started to think, well, what is the connection here to astrobiology? And it occurred to me that there actually is some potential connection. I'm just speculating now. When we talk about the supernovae that lead to neutron stars and black holes, core collapse supernovae, we're talking about explosions, very powerful explosions, that happen typically in and around star-forming regions. The stars that are most affected by these explosions are very massive stars, or stars that are very young in the vicinity of massive stars. With timescales of a few tens of millions of years, it's unlikely that life has really begun to develop on planets around these stars. And therefore, when these explosions occur, although certainly it's possible for an older system to be passing near a region of star formation, it's unlikely that we have life in the area just around the location of the explosion. So, you know, sometimes people talk about in science fiction, oh, your star is about to go supernova. And if it's a core collapse supernova, it just seems very difficult timing-wise for the civilization to have developed and to be there and to be measuring the supernova and doing astronomy and even thinking about moving the civilization someplace else. But for type 1A supernovae, it's different. These supernovae occur when the star that was originally the least massive in the system evolved. That is, if the single degenerate model is correct. And even later, if the double degenerate model is correct. That means that star formation occurs, and some billions of years later, perhaps tens of billions of years later or longer, there's the explosion. So these explosions happen in old systems. Systems where stars may have planets, since many stars seem to have planets, and these planets have been evolving and potentially have evolved life over a period of several billion years. Now, the kinds of binaries that are going to have type 1A supernova explosions, it's unlikely that their planets have survived with life on them to the point of the explosions. But these systems are found often in regions that are fairly densely populated with other old stars that could potentially have planets around them. So if we are talking about civilizations, if anybody here is a science fiction writer, okay, and you're talking about a civilization where life could be destroyed by a supernova, it's much more likely that it's going to be destroyed by a type 1A supernova than by a core collapse supernova. Right? Now, this may sound kind of funny, but it's interesting. There is a great coming together of astronomy and biology now in the area of astrobiology. And one very interesting area is the area where you ask yourself, what kinds of astronomical events will cut off the development of civilizations? And so in our own galaxy, we talk about the galactic zone of habitability that starts a few kiloparsecs from the center and extends outward in a ring. And so the question is, and I've seen calculations of this that have considered type 2 supernovae, and I started reading over the weekend everything I could find. I still haven't found a type 1A scenario included in this. So I think there is some interesting work to be done on what types of stellar populations are affected by these and what the long-term implications could be. Although for the short term, it's certainly cosmology. Thank you.
I just have one comment. You said that the number of observed super soft X-ray sources is not anywhere near the spectrum.
That's right. That was a great disappointment. Yeah.
I just want to point out because they have such soft X-ray temperatures and have such a luminosity. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take much to hide them.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And the majority of super soft sources are probably hidden by interstellar absorption. But the point is that the ones that are going near the Chandrasekhar limit are up here at the highest values of M dot. And since that mass is burning, they tend to have luminosities a few times 10 to the 38. And their temperatures also tend to be 100 EV or even a little bit higher. They, therefore, are very difficult to hide. And in M31, for example, we're probably complete in them. That's a good point.
Yeah. It seems like there should be an energetic difference between these models, because in the single degenerate, you're exploding a thing which is just slightly bigger than the Chandrasekhar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Double degenerate, you're starting with something which could be close to twice the Chandrasekhar.
Right.
So you're starting with a lot more mass in the second case. But I guess the dynamics of the explosion is not understood well enough to make a prediction for how bright these things should be based on the initial mass involved.
Okay, this is an excellent question. And people have conjectured that maybe some of these differences between, not, as I said at the beginning, not all type 1A supernovae are identical. And maybe what you're talking about is some of the things that introduce diversity into the population. However, as Lars will tell you when he gives his talk, this double degenerate scenario is very difficult to compute the explosion and to compute explosions that seem to be consistent with what we see in the supernova. So I'm telling you all the problems with this scenario, which is the one I've spent a lot of time working on, which I know and love, but may be wrong. However, when he speaks, he'll tell you that you can actually maybe, we think, generate explosions that look like type 1A supernovae in this scenario, but that it seems to be more difficult to do it here. So this is, again, a very good question, and it's one that's very difficult to answer, and it's a whole different kind of physics that comes into that calculation.
I don't question.
I'm sure you don't.
you didn't mention it, but would this tell us anything about the origin of cosmic rays?
Well, that's interesting. Supernovae, of course, are places where people think that cosmic rays are formed. I personally don't know much about the difference between core collapse supernovae in that regard and type 1A. Is there anybody who'd like to comment on that?
The acceleration is really in the supernova remnant.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have much to do with what the origin of the energy for the shock in the interstellar gas is. That's what we said.
Yeah, and by the remnant, we really mean this, you know, gaseous thing all around that's there in either case. Okay, Ed, there was another question.
Yeah, it's just sort of one of philosophy in that we have all these channels in which we might be able to get things to go boom, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at some level, we have first principle capabilities up to a limit of saying, okay, this channel should look like X.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing a lot of searching for things that look like type 1A. What about the things that don't look like type 1A?
That's exactly my point. That's an excellent question, right? There are going to be an awful lot of things that don't look like type 1As.
And
in fact, they dominate. And that's one of the questions that we've been bringing up in talks, you know, through the workshop and in the conference, is what do the other things look like? Because I'm sure that pan stars and LSST, if not data that already exists. I mean, it could very well be in data that already exists, and some of us have been talking about that as well, must have evidence of these other types of mergers. These mergers are predicted, and they must be occurring, and we should see them. And so if we can make sure that PanSTARRS and LSST are alert to these things and they don't throw them out, these types of events should give us calibration points. And in fact, Sri Kulkarni was here, I guess, during the conference, or was it last week? He was here at some point, I think during the conference for Ken Nomoto's birthday. And one of the things that I and many people are working on him with are the predictions of transients. And one thing he would like to have happen, and perhaps we can work on this here at KITP over this period, is to actually compute the relative rates of all these different types of events so that searches for them can be effective once LSST gets underway. So anybody who's interested in that problem, and I see a number of people in the audience who I think are probably interested in that, that's certainly something we can and probably should be working on over the next couple of months.
Can you comment on whether or not we already have data? You know, for example, we hear a lot about type 1A discovery. You know, there's another type 1A here, there. Are there existing constraints already in data that we're just not paying attention to, or?
Does anybody know the answer to that? I mean, we've discussed this during your talk, right?
Well, no, people don't throw out supernovae because they don't look like type 1A.
Right.
Well, I can't really say that. We actually had a discussion at the meeting because there's a type of supernova that has hydrogen, which normally would mean it's not a type 1A, but has an underlying spectrum that looks like a normal type 1A. And people are saying it's probably not a type 1A because it has this hydrogen around it. And it seems to go against the trend of your talk, that there are other possibilities in blowing these things up. We really have to be careful not to throw out the odd ones because it's another category or another type. So I don't exactly know what the answer to the question is, but in general, 1As are fairly consistent observationally, and if there's odd ones, and there are some odd ones out there, we're certainly interested in them and trying to figure out what their origin is.
And I think these future programs will definitely, they're not particularly looking for type 1As, although they certainly will be very happy to find them. So I think they're going to make a lot of progress that way.
Some searches are tuned to find type 1A supernovae because you want to do the high redshift ones and do the cosmology problem or do nearby ones to compare with the distant ones. And so things like the color and the rate at which they rise that are characteristics of the type 1A are used to select the objects that you follow up. Mm-hmm. But there are also searches done by amateurs, turns out, and by searching for nearby supernovae where when somebody finds something, we look at every one of them. And in those cases, you get a sample that, of course, is biased by the bright ones. You can search over a bigger volume, and the dim ones, the intrinsically dim ones, you search over a smaller volume, so they look rare even if they're not. And what's happening now is that the sample size has gone from a few hundred up toward 1,000, and so that some rarer events are beginning to show up. So we will see these eventually, and some of them were, the searches are capable of finding. There are others where the searches are being tuned up to find a particular type, and they certainly are throwing these out.
That's going to be very exciting in the next 10 years. Just as the past decade has really led to some incredible progress. Thank you.